What does it take to be a good copy editor?
It takes flexibility. It also takes, and this is the most important thing, I think, in copy editing, or one of the most important things in copy editing, you really have to listen to what the author is trying to do on the page. It's the author's book, and you're there to polish it and to burnish it, not to turn it into what you think, what you might think constitutes good prose. You're trying to make the author's prose really sing.
That's Benjamin Dreyer, author of the surprise bestseller, Dreyer's English. Then we re-air our 2007 interview with Kitty Burns Flores about her book, Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog. It's all about the joy of diagramming sentences. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Even though he's Random House's chief copy editor, Benjamin Dreyer was pleasantly shocked when his book about copy editing took off as a bestseller within days of being published. Evidently, a lot of people want to improve their English, despite the influence of Twitter. Dreyer's two decades at Random House have made him a master in the art as well as the craft of copy editing. He burnishes manuscripts to a gleam so that the author's voice can really shine. His book, Dreyer's English, An Utterly Correct Guide to Clarity and Style, is chock full of advice, insider wisdom, and fun facts. It offers lessons on punctuation from the semicolon to the end dash, the rules and non-rules of grammar, including why it's okay to begin a sentence with and or but, and how to avoid such throat-clearers as very, rather, of course, and the dreaded actually. Benjamin Dreyer is copy editing chief of the Random House division of Penguin Random House and its managing editor. Benjamin Dreyer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, it's interesting. I always thought that copy editing meant that you had to be an expert in grammar and punctuation, but, you know, it was mostly just a science. But after reading this book, I realized how much of an art copy editing is.
It's nice to hear it called an art. I will tend to think of it somewhat self-deprecatingly as a craft. The funny thing is that I sort of learned to copy edit. Well, I learned to copy edit by observing copy editing going on when I was a proofreader. And you would be reading your typeset pages against the manuscript, and you would see the manuscript all fully marked up with whatever had gone on between the copy editor and the author. And that's how I learned to copy edit. I always had a knack for this sort of thing, but it did become necessary as I started to do it professionally to learn all of the things about how the English language works that I had never quite learned in school.
Can you think of one of those as an example right now?
Oh, there are so many of them. You know, I knew the difference between a subject and a predicate. I knew the difference between an adjective and an adverb, but I'd never heard of the subjunctive until I started doing this sort of work. I had a perfectly pleasant suburban high school education. It just wasn't all that deep in this sort of thing.
Well, before we go any further, tell our listeners, what does a copy editor do?
What a copy editor does is, after the person I tend to refer to as the editor, and that's the person who likely brought the manuscript into the house, has been working with the author on it draft after draft for, you know, probably a couple of years to get everything the way it's supposed to be. And they do, you know, that sort of work is very big ticket stuff. It's narrative arc, it's characterization, it's pace, it's all the things that go into refining a book into its essentially finished form. So once it's essentially finished, that's when a copy editor gets to work on it. And copy editors do the mechanical sorts of things. They, of course, are checking to make sure that all the words are spelled correctly. They are tidying up the punctuation. They are indeed looking to make sure that sentences are grammatically sound, making sure that the subjects and the verbs agree in number, all that sort of thing. But you're also, as a copy editor, this is where it really does become a craft. You are trying to just help enhance the author's voice to clarify sentences that may not be as clear as the author might have intended them to be. And you're also on the lookout, because all authors have tics and habits, repetitions of certain phrases, repetitions of certain constructions. We all have a tendency to write in threes. It's a very natural way of expressing yourself. And I do it all the time. But writers do it all the time. And you'll begin to notice as you're working on a manuscript that in this paragraph or two, the writer has repeatedly done things in series of threes. And you might want to call that out to the writer. Mm. Basically, it's a collection of tricks, and you just accumulate them as you're doing this sort of work, and you apply them in a unique way to every manuscript. I mean, every manuscript gets its own copy edit, but there are things you're always on the lookout for.
So you said that it's a craft. Now, crafts take a long time to become masters at. What was the process for you in, you know, from the time you started out as a lowly proofreader to where you are now? Where could you see some of the stages that you went through?
Well, first off, I fell into this whole thing by accident. I was about 30 years old. I didn't really have a career. I hadn't done much after college except amuse myself. And I began to work as a freelance proofreader because a writer friend of mine suggested that I might be good at it. And he introduced me to his production editor. The production editor is the person in a publishing house who squires a book through the process, the person who hires the copy editor, the person who hires the proofreaders. So he introduced me to his production editor, and she just took a chance on me, which was lovely. You know, gave me a job right out. Also gave me excellent specific feedback, job after job. She was a wonderful mentor. I'm most grateful to her for that. And as I said, as I was proofreading, I observed the copy editing that was going on in the margins of these books, that was going on in the margins of the manuscripts. And I began to sort of teach myself how copy editing worked. I mean, I was observing it, I was absorbing it. And at a certain point, I did say to her, you know, do you think I could be a copy editor? And she said, well, let's find out. And maybe a year and a half had gone by, but I'd been doing a lot of this work. Rather than go through my entire career month by month, I was eventually hired at Random House about 25 years ago as a production editor. And then I just gradually became what I am now, which is the copy chief and the managing editor. I don't copy edit as much as I used to. I mean, I haven't in years because I have so much other job that needs to be done. But I keep my hand in. I have one author I copy edit when she presents a new book. And it takes a long time. It takes a long time, particularly when you're young and maybe not so secure in your abilities, and you pull into a world where you are there to determine what is correct and what is incorrect. I was much more rigid when I started out. Not, I think, a bad copy editor, just not as good a copy editor as I grew up to be. It takes flexibility. It also takes, and this is the most important thing, I think, in copy editing, or one of the most important things in copy editing, you really have to listen to what the author is trying to do on the page. It's the author's book, and you're there to polish it and to burnish it, not to turn it into what you think. What you might think constitutes good prose. You're trying to make the author's prose really sing.
Yeah, I'm so struck by your use of these auditory words. Listen, the author sing. We talk about the author's voice. I wonder if this comes from kind of the heart of literature being something that's heard.
I think that there's a great big difference in how we speak and how we write, for sure. I would never like to see myself, written down precisely the way the words were coming out of my mouth without the ability to go in and clean them up a little bit. But there is much to say about the sound of prose. I think it's one of the things that I say in the book, that you should be able to read prose aloud and it should make sense. And I have often found as a copy editor that if I'm working on something and something is bothering me, I can't quite tell what's what's off about a particular sentence, if I read it aloud, I can hear what's the matter with it. But prose, yeah, I mean, I love to read aloud, and I love to listen to prose being read. It still connects that way. I mean, maybe it goes all the way back to, you know, having a parent read to you and that particular magic, which of course then leads to the magic of your figuring out that these symbols and characters on a page match up with the noise that you're hearing. It's very mysterious.
Yeah, and I actually think it goes back to the whole original oral tradition of literature. If we think of Homer, that was never actually written down. You talk in the book, Benjamin Dreyer, in this wonderful book, and I have to say, it is such an entertaining read. Dreyer's English, I think it's the only book about a subject like grammar and punctuation that is a delight to read. You talk about the four C's, convention, consensus, clarity, and comprehension. Give us a sense of those.
You know, I mean, it was a funny thing when I wrote that up. I was rolling my eyes at myself over having, you know, resorted to alliteration, but it just amused me in the moment to do that. I think there's the notion, particularly of consensus, in that as far as copy editing is concerned, there's a balance you're trying to strike between enhancing the author's voice, but also on occasion, there's a slightly sort of conservative feeling about copy editing, pulling the author into what are deemed to be standard uses of the English language, standard uses of particular words, so that the reader isn't being, you know, popped out of the reading by something that strikes the reader as peculiar or dangerously unconventional. And I'm not meaning that you're flattening everything out, but as I do like to say, if you're going to irritate a reader on purpose and for a good reason. So so that's consensus. And what are my other three C's?
Well, there's convention.
Yes.
And of course, I think clarity and comprehension are pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, I do. I mean, particularly as far as clarity is concerned, I think that a good sentence is one that you should be able to read it from the beginning to the end, no matter how long the sentence is, and not because the writer has perhaps misdirected you with an odd piece of punctuation or perhaps a word that could be mistaken as either a noun or a verb, as some words can be. So you're halfway through the sentence and you're thinking, oh, I misread that, so let me go back and start again. I think that you should not have to do that. I think there's no reason not to read a sentence two or three times because you think it's beautiful. But I don't necessarily think you should have to go back and reread a sentence because you couldn't follow it.
And talking about length, you know, it seems to be that the convention is, in much American literature, to have short sentences. And yet one of my favorite writers is W.G. Zabald, or was, he's not with us anymore, and he wasn't an American. His sentences are very long. He comes from a German tradition, and yet each word leads you along to the next one, and I never have to reread his sentences. So I wonder if you could talk about what makes a good sentence.
I think I write in rather long sentences with little digressions and parentheticals. And of course, you will either be amused or not amused by the fact that my book sort of sits on a sea of footnotes because my mind is always going someplace else. So I want to plant a piece of information just sort of down at the bottom of the page so we can have this little private conversation. Then we'll go back up to the text. There are writers who do like to write in long Baroque sentences. And I enjoy that. When you can pull that off, that's a great thing. And there are writers who write in simpler, punchier sentences. I think they're all fine. I like all writing as long as it's good writing, which is perilously close to talking in a circle. But it's how it comes out of you. I think that perhaps a penchant for shorter sentences may have something to do with, communicating with readers who want to get that information. They just want it. So don't go on too long. Don't be too elaborate. I also relatedly have certainly noticed over the last few decades that we punctuate a little less. Everybody seems to punctuate a little less than we used to. And I think that's also a sense of let's move this on.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And maybe it also has to do with how much we write on our phones, where it's kind of a drag to kind of hunt for that comma. But I just finished a manuscript, and after I read your book, I had to go back and do quite a bit of changing. First, I worked on the punctuation. So yeah, there was that comma. You know, when I grew up, you had to put commas. It was a series comma, and you had to put it after every word. And then all of a sudden, this convention came on where the last of the series loses the comma. So I started following that. And then I read your book, and I went back, and I had to put in the comma everywhere.
I'm a big fan of that last comma, the comma that people call either the Oxford comma or the serial comma or the series comma, which is simply the comma that if you're writing a construction like apples, pears, and cherries, it's apples, comma, pears, comma, and cherries. That comma before the and cherries, that's the series comma, and that's the one that some people don't believe is necessary. To sort of rough it in very generally, I think that most book people are great fans of the series comma, and most people who have been raised or worked in journalism, particularly those who follow AP style, have been taught not to use that comma. And of course, the funny thing about that sort of thing is you like what you're used to, and you often find yourself disliking what you're not used to. And you could make arguments in favor of either side. I just dig my heels in because I took a side and I'm going to stay on it.
Well, and it actually makes sense because, as you point out in the book, Benjamin Dreyer, as you point out in Dreyer's English, there are sometimes when, because of the nature of the series, if you don't have that comma in there, you're going to misconstrue what's being said.
Yes, you can often, I think, if you don't have a series comma, the last two items in a series may seem to have a particular unity, a particular relationship that they don't, in fact, have. So I think that the comma just neatly separates them. The funny thing is that I find that writers who claim not to like the series comma or who say, well, I'll use it when I think it's necessary and I won't use it when I think it's not necessary, which, of course, is very difficult for the copy editorial brain, which does want things to be consistent. It's very difficult for my brain to sort of deal with that sort of thing. But I have found that writers who claim not to like the series comma will often use it when even I wouldn't be confused by its absence. And then in some string of not, you know, apples, bananas, and pears, but three rather long phrases where one would really be helped by having the last two separated with a comma so that you knew they were separate, that's when they don't want to use that comma. So I find that a little maddening.
And now one of my favorite punctuation marks is a semicolon, which seems to be going sadly out of style. You have a wonderful little section in the book in Dreyer's English about Shirley Jackson, who actually is a writer I didn't know. You point out a passage where she uses the semicolons a lot. Tell us why it's so perfect there.
Semicolons are wonderful, wonderful pieces of punctuation because what they do for you is they hold together two sentences that might, obviously, if you were separating them with a period, they would exist as two separate things, but you're trying to keep them a little bit closer to each other. You're trying to make sure that the reader knows that this is the first part of a longish thought, and here comes the second part of the longish thought. She uses them, Shirley Jackson, that is, uses them a lot. And in the opening paragraph of The Haunting of Hill House, which I guess if Shirley Jackson is my favorite writer in the English language, which she is, and The Haunting of Hill House is my favorite book of hers, I guess then that means that The Haunting of Hill House is my favorite book in the English language. She uses maybe three or four of them in the opening paragraph, and they hold her sentences really tight. And what they also do is to help create something that I think that she's very intentionally trying to create, which is a slight sort of claustrophobia. Everything is very held together, and you're sort of like in there, stuck where she wants you to be. And it's it's very effective. And there are a number of writers who I need not name who've said rather silly things about semicolons, like you only use them so that people will think you went to college. And it's why you should disparage that particular piece of punctuation, which has so many uses. It's like writing with a hand tied behind your back.
Yeah, and you got to edit something by Shirley Jackson that's not published. You want to tell us about that?
A few years ago, one of the editors got under submission a collection of material that had either not been collected before, because Jackson used to work for a lot of the, well, she used to work for a lot of the ladies' magazines. She used to write for Red Book, which is funny when you think about a woman who's mostly known for writing things that terrify people, that she was writing for, you know, Red Book and the Ladies' Home Journal. So this collection was a number of those pieces that had just sort of never been in a single volume before, but they were also a number of things that she had written that had never been published at all before. And when I was first given a look at this material, because as soon as I found out we were doing it, it was essentially, anybody else steps near this manuscript, there's going to be trouble. This one's mine, and I'm going to work on this. And what was wonderful was to see these Xeroxes of her original typescripts. She had, and I had learned this before, her first drafts were always all lowercase. She was typing on a typewriter. She didn't want to take the time to hit the shift key. So I'm looking at these things, and it's like, well, yeah, that's Shirley Jackson, all right. And of course, I'm recognizing the writing because she sounds so implacably like her. And what I also found as I did get to work on the material was that for first drafts, they were quite finished. The writing was just superb. And as I did work on the copy edit of this material, I had to deal with the fact that I had an author who was not going to be able to respond to my copy editing because she'd been dead for 50 years. And of course, two of her adult children were the editors and the executors, but it's a different thing when you're not talking to your writer. So I set out at the very beginning to do as little as I possibly could. I thought I could do whatever I want with punctuation, and I may want to add or drop a word here or there, or replace a noun with a pronoun if I thought that would be helpful, or the other way around. And to my delight, I found that the writing was so good just the way it was that my setting myself that restriction worked just fine. It didn't need all that much help. I mean, I was happy to sort of dust it off and clean it up. And I think I don't think any writer's writing should be sent out into the world raw, but I didn't have to do all that much. And it pleased me.
Now, I'd like to talk about non-rules. On page 15, you quote a wonderful passage from Charles Dickens' Bleak House. And I'm doing this because I think it's important for people to understand that you're not necessarily a stickler for the rules. The rules are there as a kind of armature, a structure, but that when there's a reason to violate them, one should. So there's this passage from Charles Dickens' Bleak House in which he violates all kinds of rules, especially fragmentary sentences. And it's very powerful. So talk about the non-rules.
There are a lot of things that I think most of us were taught when we were in, you know, elementary school and learning to write, and we get them drummed into our heads and then we never think about them again. And they include things like don't begin a sentence with the word and or the word but, don't split infinitives, which is to say, for instance, instead of saying to boldly go where no man or where no one, as that Star Trek phrase was eventually rewritten, to boldly go, that's a split infinitive. So if you don't believe in split infinitives, you would say boldly to go or to go boldly. The comment I remember reading about split infinitives once was that the prescription against them was devised by somebody who, all things taken into account, would have preferred that we were all speaking Latin rather than speaking English. And then, you know, sentence fragments. And I remember that when, you know, you're doing your elementary school compositions and the teacher is grading you on them, Well, certainly you know never to begin a sentence with an and or a but, and you know so well not to write sentence fragments that you're probably terrified out of writing them all together. But the thing is, there may be reasons, I suppose, in trying to teach children conventional ways of writing conventionally that do support a rudimentary notion of how English works and how you can express yourself best. But when we grow up and we become writers, then you have to stop and think, why am I following this rule? Is this rule serving me or is this rule not serving me? And then to go to the point that you raised, the opening paragraph of Bleak House is a collection of sentence fragments. There isn't one sentence in the bunch. And it's just gorgeous. And there's nothing there to criticize. There's nothing there to say, this doesn't work. And clearly, for whatever reasons, Dickens did what he was doing on purpose. And he can, because he's Charles Dickens. But you can too, whether you're Charles Dickens or not, and probably you're not. I think it's always a good thing to learn rules and conventions of good writing. And once you've gotten them under your belt, it's a good thing to break them for a good reason.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Random House's chief copy editor, Benjamin Dreyer, about his book, Dreyer's English. It's a romp through the art and craft of copy editing. Right. And I have to say, he uses one of the words that you have a list of words that one shouldn't use ever, although you do use some of them in your book. One of them is very, and I get it. I went through my entire manuscript a couple of days ago, which is 275 pages, and I was shocked to find how many of the forbidden words I used and used repeatedly, and very was one of them, and I probably took out 80% of them. However, there's one use of it. He says the horses were splashed to their very blinkers. And that use of the word very, I think there are a number of words in the English language, I think, that are kind of like that, that are not used, he's not saying they're very blinkered, they're splashed to their very blinkers. And it's very particular.
Right, like down to their very souls. I think one thing that I like to emphasize about my list of the words that you can do without is that I do say simply, try doing without them for a week just to test yourself. And as I also say, yes, do write the word very or rather or quite, but then maybe go back and take some of them out. To speak particularly on the subject of the word very, which of course we all use all the time when we speak, and if I ever sat and policed anybody else's speech, if I ever sat and policed my own speech, the way I try to keep an eye on writing, I would go mute very quickly. I would become so self-conscious that I wouldn't be able to say anything. Very, as an emphasizer, I find often accomplishes the opposite of what you mean it to. You are trying to make a point stronger, and you end up sounding somewhat pleading. I mean, to say that somebody is brilliant, that's strong and that's definitive. To say that somebody's, he's very brilliant, it's like, thank you, yes. You're just hitting it more than it needs to be hit. And in all instances, I think that you should look at something. If somebody is very smart, that person is brilliant. If somebody is very hungry, that person is ravenous. If somebody is very tired, that person is exhausted. So maybe find a stronger way to say that. Find a stronger adjective and just use it on its own. But on the other hand, I do want to point out that a friend of mine, the wonderful writer Amy Bloom, once metaphorically slapped my hand over that, and she said, Benjamin, sometimes very is just precisely the kind of quiet, quotidian, unnoticeable emphasizer you need. Two little syllables, they aren't hurting anybody. And of course she's correct, but just be mindful. And the thing is, if you are writing, I think you should write. We all write with a certain level of self-consciousness, to be sure. I mean, we're in the process of composing something, and I suppose there are writers who go into a fugue state, and the next thing you know, you've written 25 pages. I just don't happen to be that sort of person. But write the way you write, but then go back and look at what you've written, and you can start to do your own polishing act.
And read it out loud, which I find the most helpful thing to do.
Always read it out loud. You know, prose should be able to be voiced. And when you read things out loud, you yourself can readily hear what's not working. And of course, when you read things out loud is also when you're apt to like find all your bad typing.
Yeah, that is for sure. Now, it was quite a few years ago. That's another one of those. It was quite a few years ago that I interviewed a couple of linguists. And they, I was to my surprise, they took the point of view that grammar is always changing and one should not fight it. However, there are certain grammar things. And I was so happy to see that, like me, you eschew the mixing up of lay and lie. So I wonder if you could explain that for our listeners, because this is just one of my pet peeves.
Grammar, boy, grammar is a pain in the neck sometimes. And what I do try to do in the book is to use as little grammar jargon as I can possibly get away with, because if these terms don't mean anything to you, then it's not going to necessarily help for somebody to keep explaining things to you in terms of grammar terminology. But as I do say, if you want to learn the difference between lie and lay and lane and laid and all the rest of them, you're going to have to like confront the grammar of it. I mean, essentially, a person who becomes recumbent is lying down. I lie, I am lying. But the problem is, yes, but then let's get to the past tense of that. I lay down yesterday. And when you're talking about the verb to lay, you're talking about a verb that in fact requires an object, as a chicken lays an egg, or I lay a plate on the table. So, as I say, dog-ear the page, because either you're going to drill it into your head and memorize it, and probably you're not, but you should always feel free to like stop and look something up. I mean, it's like, I'm happy for you to have my book on your desk, in the same way that it's like I would never write without a dictionary sitting on my desk or accessing it online. That you can't know everything and you can't remember everything. And the good thing is to have the instinct to know when you need to look something up.
Exactly. So aside from the dictionary, and which you recommend is the Webster's Collegiate 11th edition. Why the 11th edition?
When I started in publishing, it was the Merriam-Webster Collegiate Dictionary, the 9th edition. And then a few years later was the 10th edition. Now it's the 11th edition. And it's been the 11th edition for a long time. And I have friends at the Merriam-Webster Company. I have lovely friends at the Merriam-Webster Company. They're smart and delightful, and we share secrets. The process of creating a new print dictionary is extraordinarily expensive. It will require an entire book being reset. And you know how densely dictionaries are set. So a lot of the work that they do in updating language these last few years, they do it online. So if you go to Merriam-Webster online, you're going to get things and see things that you might not necessarily see in the dictionary. That dictionary has been print a long time. But a dictionary on a desk is a wonderful thing because it's got so much in it, and also it leads to the wonderful thing of accidentally finding something you weren't looking for in the first place, because maybe there's a word next to the one that you're looking for where you it'll catch your eye and you'll glance at it. So yes, you should have a dictionary on your desk.
I've mentioned I just finished a book. That's probably why I'm talking about it, because it was 15 years in the making. And I've been over it about a million times, but it's amazing how many repeated words, dropped words I found, forbidden words. Do you have any tricks for authors in proofreading their own books other than ones you've already pointed to?
I think that, and not to speak against what I'm trying to do with the book, because what I'm trying to do with the book is to create something that is useful for writers so that they can do for their own work what I would do if I were doing it for them, but I just can't be everywhere. I think that sooner or later, you can polish your work and you can write well and you can look out for your own bad habits and you can tidy things up. Sooner or later, you need somebody else looking at something. If it's important, then somebody else needs to look at it. I mean, to be certain, my book was copy edited. My book was copy edited vigorously, and it was proofread vigorously. And it is much the better for having been copy edited and for having been proofread. My copy editor got in and did for me what I've always tried to do for other writers. You know, pointed out my bad habits, pointed out my repetitions, tightened up some of my sentences, unknotted some of my twisty sentences. She did a marvelous job, and the book is all the better for it. And then you want proofreaders in there because proofreaders are the people who, you know, who are there to catch all the little things that may have gotten past everybody. So you can't do everything yourself.
Well, but this is a terrific start. Dreyer's English, and utterly a correct guide. We didn't even get into the L-Y words, but we'll leave that up to our listeners to get the book and find out about them. An utterly correct guide to clarity and style. It's just been a pleasure to talk with you, Benjamin Dreyer.
Thank you. I've had a wonderful time talking to you, too.
Benjamin Dreyer is chief copy editor of the Random House division of Penguin Random House and its managing editor. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt of Dreyer's English. Next up, the arcane delight of diagramming sentences. Stay tuned after the break.
He asked me if I'm real. I said, yeah. Diamond shine, cause they really diamond. Diamond really diamond. And I'm shining bright, cause I'm really grinding. They ask me if I'm real. I say, you should sleep. My daughter gon' love this picture. All my diamonds shine, cause they really diamond.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I mentioned to our previous guest, Benjamin Dreyer, that in public school, I learned to diagram sentences, and it was so much fun. So back in 2007, when Kitty Burns Florian came out with her book about the art of diagramming sentences, Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog, I lost no time in booking her on the show. What follows is most of that interview. Well, listeners, I don't know about you, but when I was in grade school, one of the few fun things I can remember about the experience was diagramming sentences. Instituted as a way to teach children grammar, diagramming was in vogue from the early years of the 20th century until the 1970s. Many decry the poor grammatical skills of today's college students, who were born after diagramming sentences went out of vogue. Is there a connection? I don't know, but my next guest, Kitty Burns Flory, knows all about diagramming sentences. She was a copy editor for many years, and she wrote an essay for Harper's Magazine several years ago that she's expanded into a charming and instructive book, Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog. Well, since your book, Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog, is such a marvelously written book, I wonder if we could start out this interview actually by having you read something from the very first page.
I would love to.
Okay.
All right. Diagramming sentences is one of those lost skills, like darning socks or playing the sack butt, that no one seems to miss. When it was introduced in an 1877 text called Higher Lessons in English by Alonzo Reed and Brainerd Kellogg, it swept through American public schools like the measles, embraced by teachers as the way to reform students who were engaged in, to take Henry Higgins slightly out of context, the cold-blooded murder of the English tongue. By promoting the beautifully logical rules of syntax, diagramming would root out evils like him and me went and I ain't got none, until everybody wrote like Ralph Waldo Emerson, or at least James Fenimore Cooper. Even in my own youth, many years after 1877, diagramming was serious business. I learned it in the sixth grade from Sister Bernadette.
So tell us, who was Sister Bernadette?
Sister Bernadette was a very tiny, very brisk, very smart little nun who took no nonsense but was quite nice. She wasn't one of the mean ones. and she taught us how to diagram. And I have never forgotten what she taught me, so she must have been pretty good.
So tell us, what is diagramming sentences?
Diagramming sentences is a system of lines and angles. It looks like a road map, and the words are strung out on those lines, as I said in the book, like clothes on the wash. So you can see them. You can see exactly where they go. You can see what modifies what. And it's a diagram showing what language looks like. It's pretty extraordinary.
A diagram that shows what language looks like, how does it do that? This is one of the few times that I feel that radio is at a disadvantage, because your book is filled with the most incredibly complex drawings, constructions. I wonder if you could just auditorily orient us to this visual medium.
I can start with the sentence Sister Bernadette started with, which in my recollection is, the dog barked. And you draw a straight line, and you write dog on the left side of the line. You write barked on the right side of the line. And you bisect the line with a little short line between those two words. And the word the goes under the word dog at an angle going off to the right, so that you can see that the modifies dog. And if it was the brown dog, brown would go on another little line next to the to show that you're talking about a brown dog. And so dog is the subject of the sentence. It goes on the left. Walked is the predicate or the verb. It goes on the right. And there you have it. It's pretty simple, at least when you're doing the dog barked. And then when you've got the dog doing a lot of other complicated things, of course, it gets a little crazier looking. But that's the basic, those are the basic elements of sentence diagramming.
Now, you said subject and predicate or verb. Tell us, what are some of the important grammatical concepts that are involved with diagramming?
I think that one of the important things is to show exactly what modifies what, so that when you have a sentence like, and I'm trying to think of an example, if you have a sentence like, trotting down the road in a red collar, I spotted the dog, there's something very, very wrong with that sentence, and it's what is known as a misplaced modifier or a dangling modifier. What is meant by the sentence is, I spotted the dog as I was walking down the road, and he was trotting down the road in a red collar. It's a mistake that a lot of people make. But when you diagram that sentence, trotting down the road in a red collar, I spotted the dog, you realize that it's I who is trotting down the road in a red collar, according to the way the sentence is arranged. And you can immediately see, at least Sister Bernadette hoped that we could immediately see, that that was wrong, and that we would have to rephrase the sentence somehow so that it would be the dog who would be trotting.
Yeah, as you said that, trotting down the road in a red collar, I was trying to wrap my mind around that idea that you were trotting down the road in a red collar.
Right.
And there was a little disconnect there.
Right. If we had a diagram here, you would have caught on right away.
That's great. Well, you know, it's funny. I asked my 86-year-old mom about if she had studied diagramming sentences, and I assumed that she would say yes, but she didn't, and she grew up in New York City. I was very surprised, because growing up in northern New Jersey, as I did when I was a kid, we diagrammed sentences. So talk a little bit about the history of diagramming sentences, and also how common was it?
It was very, very common, and I was surprised too, because just recently I spoke to someone who grew up in New York City who didn't diagram, and I think New York City was a pocket of resistance to the Brainerd-Kellogg methods. Maybe the teachers had too much else to do to teach kids how to diagram. Maybe they just never got around to it, couldn't afford the whole concept. You know, teachers had to be trained. They had to buy all these books. But from all over the rest of the country, every single person I've talked to since this book came out last October and before when I was researching it, everyone over a certain age had diagrammed sentences. And I don't remember now what the statistics are, but I think something like 90% of American schools were using this method in the early 20th century. And it certainly hadn't died out by the time I was in school or you were in school. And in fact, my daughter had a little bit of it. She's in her 30s, and she had some. And there are places that teach it today.
Talk a little bit about the history of it, and about the early history of it. First, there was a man who didn't do it quite the same way as the Brainerd-Kellogg method. His name was S.W. Clark, and he actually went to Amherst College, which is...
Yes.
Right in this town.
Yes, right. He invented a system of diagramming that was actually a system of balloons that were hooked together. And they, as soon as I saw them, they reminded me of those balloon animals that they make at state fairs and at kids' parties. They look like little dachshunds and, you know, dinosaurs and stuff. And they're really crazy looking. But they do sort of show how the words relate to each other in a sentence.
What did this come out of, actually? Because it seems that there was something really about that time. And tell us the time that this was. It's something about that time that gave rise to a desire to bring grammar to the masses.
I think that was true. The book was published in 1877, so they were working on it at the Brooklyn Polytechnic where they taught.
This was Alonzo
Reed and Brainerd Kellogg. Yes, mm-hmm. Two very earnest professors at the institute, and they polled their colleagues and talked to a lot of people and tried things out on students, and they came up with this method, and they refined it and perfected it and published their book called Higher Lessons in English. At the time, well, of course, teachers have always thought that their kids needed, you know, some really rigorous drilling to get the language drilled into them properly. So, of course, they wanted to improve their students' writing and their use of English. But at the same time, it was a time when, in the Victorian era, in America, there was a great desire for self-improvement of all kinds. And that's when penmanship was in its heyday, and etiquette, and table manners. You know, all kinds of rules were laid down, and posture. And people had calling cards and engraved stationery, and everything was very formal and nice if you could afford it. And I think people who were upwardly mobile in those days could seize on these trappings of gentility and become ladies and gentlemen automatically if they improved their speech and stood up straight and learned how to behave the way, you know, the upper classes behaved. So the country was ripe for this method because it promised to teach kids to speak proper English.
It reminds me, we had a guest on here late last year who wrote a book called Service and Style, which was about the department store, the American department store. And what you're talking, which also its heyday was in that time,
yes,
in the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. And it was also a way to kind of bring the style of the upper class to the middle classes.
That's true. And strangely, the department stores began to die out just around the time diagramming did. You know, we don't really have very many of those old department stores that I certainly remember when I was a kid.
No, that's right.
And now we have, what do we have? We have Target and, you know, Kmart. And what are they? They're sort of department stores, but nobody would ever call them that. And they're certainly, the atmosphere is certainly not the same.
Right, although they're trying to gentrify a little bit.
Yes, but they're never, you know, there were Oriental rugs on the floor and beautiful old cash registers. And, you know, the salespeople were dressed up and they were behind glass counters.
That's right. Why do we need diagramming?
I think that diagramming can't hurt, but I don't necessarily think it's the only way to teach people how to write and speak good English by any means. And diagramming itself has problems. You have to learn how to diagram, for one thing. You have to learn this very, very involved system. And also, as I also point out in the book, and I think it's really funny, you can diagram a very bad sentence. It doesn't have to be a good sentence. You can put it on those little lines, and nothing is telling you that it's bad unless you already know it's bad.
Could you give us an example of that?
Well, I have examples in the book, mm-hmm. Which I can...
Actually, one of them is, me and him went out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's mm-hmm. no reason you can't put me and him on lines just as you could put he and I. And to a lot of people, me and him went out sounds like a perfectly good sentence. So telling them to sit down, you sit down and diagram that sentence and see what's wrong with it. You can't see what's wrong with it. But if you've had a sister Bernadette who has already instructed you in proper grammar, and then you sit down with the diagram and try to make it fit, then you will realize that it's, you know, you have to know it before you can diagram it. I see diagramming as a reinforcement of things that students have already learned, not as a way to teach it.
Now, we interviewed linguist Jeff Pullum, and he's the co-author of a book called Far From the Matting Gerund. And he took a distinctly live-and-let-live approach to grammar. He basically says that grammar usage is always changing, and it's perfectly legitimate. And you yourself say in your book that, quote, to try to hold back language change is like trying, as Monty Python would have it, to cut down the largest tree in the forest with a herring.
Exactly.
But you also are a veteran copy editor.
That's right.
Your job has been to correct mm-hmm. poor grammar. What's the balance that we want to strive for here between mm-hmm. live and let live and grammar and correct grammar?
Well, as a copy editor, I sit on a very uncomfortable fence. I am a stickler in written English and things that are going to be published. Certainly in my own books, I try very hard to make everything absolutely correct. And I think that formal written English is the last bastion of correctness and that there's absolutely no harm for it to be there. It needs to be there. It shows us what the language should be. And it's quite different from the language that people speak or write in emails or write in personal letters, if anybody writes personal letters. The language is, of course, always changing. It has to change. It's a living thing. It has changed drastically from the Middle Ages or from the Renaissance or even from 100 years ago. But I think what bothers people is when it changes too fast. And everybody always thinks that the language is changing too fast. We can certainly accept the fact that we don't speak the way we did 100 years ago. We don't talk the way Washington and Lincoln talked 200 years ago. But when we speak quite differently from the way we did, say, 20 years ago or 10 years ago, when people can remember, and of course we all idealize our childhoods, but people remember their childhood as being a time when people did speak better English. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But it's true that there's always been a sort of tension between the idea that the language has to change, should change, and becomes more interesting as it changes and with new words and new constructions, and the idea that we're losing something really important.
You say at some point in the book, as a matter of fact, it's where you actually quote or you refer to Stephen Clark, who was the first guy,
The Balloon Man,
where he compared grammar to geometry and architecture. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could say what he means, and then I'll follow it up with you.
Clark does compare it to geometry and to architecture, and I think that students who are mathematically inclined and visually inclined are the ones, besides the students who are just fascinated with language, I think that those are the students who find it fascinating and who have always found it easy and have always welcomed it as another way of looking at language, to think of it as something like a mathematical equation or like a picture, the way architecture is a picture. Grammar is like architecture. It's like an edifice in which there are all these rooms, and you know, if you look at it that way, and there's a picture in the book of one of those birdhouses that has all the parts shooting off of it for, you know, I think it's purple martins who like that kind of birdhouse. It's a structure on which you can put the language.
Say more about the birdhouses. Describe that for our listeners.
Well, in a section where I was showing how extremely complicated diagrams can become, I was at the same time looking through a book of birdhouses because I was in the market for a birdhouse for my yard, and we came across this purple martin birdhouse that all of a sudden I thought, that looks like one of these diagrams, and we have to put it in the book because, you know, you can imagine the birds going in and out of different places the way the nouns and verbs and adjectives and adverbs go in and out of all the little rooms or the little streets.
That's wonderful. Now, here's a good example, I think. And it's one of my favorite sentences in the book, although there are many wonderful, wonderful sentences in this book of all different kinds. But this is from Groucho Marx. And I think it shows us what diagramming really can do. And that is, it says, time flies like an arrow, but fruit flies like a banana.
It's all in the emphasis, yes, and it's all in the diagram. That's one sentence that becomes so clear when you diagram it that it was actually a joy to diagram it and see it on paper like that. And the diagramming guru who helped me with the diagrams and, in fact, did the really tough ones, a man named Jean Mutu from Kentucky, who has written a great book about diagramming sentences. This one I could diagram on my own. It was one of the ones that's actually fairly easy to diagram. When I sent it to him just to make sure that it was right, at first, when I had just written the sentence, he didn't really understand it. And then he saw it diagrammed, and he just cracked up. He thought that this was so funny.
Right, and you have some very long sentences. What is your favorite, most complicated sentence in the book?
My favorite one is the Proust one, because it's the longest and most complicated. And, of course, it's a little silly because Proust wrote in French, and the French didn't diagram. Nobody diagrammed but Americans. It was only an American phenomenon.
Not English?
None of the other English-speaking countries have diagrammed. They did a thing called parsing, where they just identified all the parts of speech in a sentence, but they didn't put them on lines. So our Proust example was there just to be funny because it's just such an extremely long sentence.
And it takes up, we have to say, two entire pages.
But on the other hand, so does our sentence from Jack Kerouac, which is also a beautiful, wonderful, perfectly diagrammable sentence.
Maybe read both of them just so we have a...
Okay, I will start with Kerouac because he's right here in front of me. And this is a lovely sentence. It's the last lines of his famous book, On the Road. The evening star must be drooping and shedding her sparkler dims on the prairie, which is just before the coming of complete night that blesses the earth, darkens all rivers, cups the peaks, and folds the final shore in. And nobody, nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old. Mm-hmm. So that's a lovely sentence. And then we have Proust somewhere here. It's a little unfair to Proust, to diagram Proust, because he would have, you know, run screaming in horror at the very concept of diagramming sentences.
Why?
I think that Proust just wasn't oriented that way. He was much more interested in the what the sentence would say rather than in how some teacher would put it on the blackboard with lines. The Proust sentence, which takes up 2 pages and is almost impossible to figure out from the diagram, which I think is actually another drawback of diagrams. You can put the sentence on a diagram, but you can't necessarily read it back because you don't really know where you're going. However, here's Proust. But at least if strength were granted me for long enough to accomplish my work, I should not fail, even if the results were to make them resemble monsters, to describe men first and foremost as occupying a place, a very considerable place, compared with the restricted one which is allotted to them in space, a place on the contrary prolonged past measure, for simultaneously, like giants plunged into the years, they touch epochs that are immensely far apart, separated by the slow accretion of many, many days in the dimension of time. That's a very complicated sentence.
Now, you mentioned before that it has largely fallen into disuse, but you did visit a classroom where diagramming is taught. Why don't you say a little bit about that?
I did. I visited a classroom in Greenwich Village. It was a bunch of seventh graders on Valentine's Day who were all dressed in some fairly alarming Valentine outfits, some of them. The idea was to wear red and for the girls to look as sexy as possible at age 12 or whatever they were, around 11 and 12. But aside from that, they diagrammed sentences in their English class that day, as they did every Tuesday, and they were absolutely loving it. They had such a good time. They made a lot of mistakes. The teacher was very patient with them, but you could tell that they were getting it.
Was this something you think they had been exposed to before? Was it just this
No,
teacher?
This particular teacher really believed in it. She had done it as a kid, and she had loved it, and she was determined that her students were going to do it and that they were going to like it, and they did. They were really excited.
Now, can it make you a better writer to know how to diagram sentences?
I do not believe that it makes you a better writer, and nor did this teacher who was teaching the students in this seventh grade class. I think the only thing that makes people a good writer, and it's very easy to become a good writer, you just read a lot.
Yes.
You know, it's the easy way. You don't have to study grammar. You don't have to diagram your brains out. You don't have to do anything. You just have to read books all your life, and you will be a much more competent writer. Not that we don't all make mistakes, even those of us who read a lot, but it's really an easy trick.
That's right, and it's really fun.
It's a lot more fun than diagramming sentences.
Although that's fun, too.
It is fun.
Well, the book is Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog, The Quirky History and Lost Art of Diagramming Sentences. And Kitty Florey, thanks so much for coming on to Writer's Voice today.
Thank you. It was lots of fun.
That was Kitty Burns Flores talking with Writer's Voice in 2007. Next week, we talk with filmmaker Glenn Silber about his film, just re-released, The War at Home. It's about the anti-war movement at Madison, Wisconsin in the 1960s and early 70s, a movement that I was personally part of in Madison at that time. So Silber and I have much to talk about. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.